MechCast, Friday, September 4th, 2015. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How are you doing? Welcome back to the show. Well, we are getting close, just days away from Apple's next special event, and it's looking like it's going to turn out to be a massive one. I mean, they've been getting bigger over the years, right? I've taken to call it Apple sort of barfing out products all at once. It used to be the stuff was spread out over various times of the year. Now it just kind of feels like we kind of have two events a year, and at each one of them, it's just a massive amount of products that Apple is throwing at us, and much to the detriment of my bank account, probably yours as well. But we have been getting a lot of news and information about what is coming up, what is happening. As a matter of fact, I just realized there was a little update this morning that I left out of the show notes, so I'm going to have to pause at some point. I won't tell you when. I'm going to have to pause and go out and update the show notes for that section. But even without that, there is a ton of stuff going on. There's a ton of product sort of rumors and things like that. I mean, at this point, this late stage in the game, we kind of have a pretty good idea of what Apple is going to announce, but there's always a surprise or two in there. And I'm getting super excited. I don't know about you, but, you know, the event has been announced. It's going to happen on the 9th. You know that because we've talked about that on the show. So next week, Wednesday, 10 a.m., Apple and their executives and their team will be taking the stage and talking about all the new great products that they're going to have for us this fall, moving into the end of the year. So we're going to be talking about all of those in the show. So that means things like new iPhones and iPads, Apple TVs, maybe a few other odds and ends products in there. We've got a little update on what's going on with Apple Watch. Also, I want to talk to you about some stolen Apple accounts. A lot of people concerned about that and why you may not have to be that concerned about that, which is a good thing. Also, some new processors from Intel, which may mean some new Macs in our future. We've got all of that, and then I've got a little bit of follow-up to my rant about the Genius Bar, questions about shuffling albums in iTunes, iCloud photo library storage, getting ready for a new operating system right around the corner. We're going to be talking about all of that in this episode, but before we get into that stuff, let me take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, do you want to get cash for your old iPhone? Gazelle really makes this process easy. And as I just mentioned, new iPhones are right around the corner. We're literally just, you know, a weeks away from brand new iPhones. And maybe you want to pick one of those up, and maybe you want to offset the cost with some cash, getting some cash for your old device. Now is the time to do that. Now is the time to head over to gazelle.com and lock in your deal. Get your offer, lock in your deal. Right now, last night I checked, AT&T 6 GB iPhone 6 in good condition is going for about $300 on Gazelle. You can get $300 for that thing. That is going to let you help you really pay for your new iPhone 6S or maybe 6S Plus if you want to upgrade to the larger one. But hurry, because the longer you wait, the price goes down. So you want to get over there, you want to lock in. And it's free. It's easy to get your quote, your online offer. You just have to answer a few easy questions. You get an instant price quote right there. And don't even worry if you have a broken phone. Gazelle will accept those too. Just head over to gazelle.com, plug in your info, and see what your offer is. And once you accept the Gazelle offer, they're going to honor it for 30 days. So you can lock in now, get your new device, and then ship your old one off to Gazelle and get cash. And shipping is free too. In many cases, they provide a box for you. It really could not be easier. I've been using Gazelle for years, and it's really great. All your personal information, once they receive it and process it, is removed from your device, so you don't have to worry about that. And the payments are fast. You can get paid by check in the mail. You can get paid by Amazon gift card. That goes directly to your email, so that's a quick way. Plus, they give you 5% more on your offer. Or you can do a direct deposit into your PayPal account. There's lots of options. And Gazelle's not a fly-by-night company. They have been around for years. They have over 1 million customers, and they've paid out over $200 million to those customers. So get cash for your old iPhone. Lock in your price today, and you'll have 30 days to send it in. That should give you plenty of time to get that new one. Just go to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. So I guess this is the episode where we're going to be doing kind of our, I don't know if I want to call it a rumor roundup, or it's more like an everything we think we know about Apple's event. And I figure the best way to go through this with you is to kind of just go down the line, take it product by product, and, you know, see what's up with all the new things we're expecting Apple to announce next week. So I figured the logical place to start is going to be where Apple will likely start, which is with new iPhones. I don't think they're going to save that to the last, because I think there's actually going to be a bigger announcement that's going to be the last one. We'll talk about that in a little bit. You can probably speculate what that is, though, at this point, right? A lot of us know what we think we're going to see at this event. But the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus should be coming. It's expected that they're going to be just a fraction thicker because of the new touch, force touch enabled display. So just a hair thicker, also a little bit thicker because of the case material, supposedly going to be made from that 7000 series aluminum, just like the Apple Watch is. The new A9 processor is expected to bring about 30% improvement in performance with about 35% better battery life, or better power efficiency, I guess I should say. Whether that translates into actual longer battery life on the new phones is going to come down to if Apple has put, you know, kept the battery size the same or not. And we haven't really heard about that. Typically, they'll often make the battery a little bit smaller to cram in some larger components. And there certainly is going to be a few more things in here that Apple has to fit in that same space, because the physical size of the device is expected to remain the same, with the 6S being the 4.7 inches and the 6S Plus being the 5.5, just like the current 6 Plus. But it is expected that Apple will finally up the iPhone RAM to 2 gigabytes from 1 gigabyte, so they got more RAM chips to get in there. And it's also expected that they're going to totally overhaul the camera systems, both in the EyeSight camera and in the FaceTime camera. For the EyeSight camera, it's looking like it's going to be a 12-megapixel sensor with improved signal processing in the A9 chip, so should be better all the way around. There does seem to be some debate on whether or not the iPhone's going to be capable of recording video in full 4K resolution. For my sort of thoughts on that, I do think that Apple will move up to 4K in this release. I think some of the competitors are starting to move in that direction. And as much as I don't think 4K is going to be a big thing in this year, I think just sort of future-proofing, or just kind of having that spec, is going to be important. So I do think we're going to see 4K video capture in the new iPhones. For the FaceTime camera, it's expected Apple's going to go all the way up to a 5-megapixel FaceTime camera. So this is going to be a big jump on the FaceTime camera, because I think the current version is 1.2 megapixels. And we've been hearing these reports that there's going to be support for a front-facing flash. And when I first heard this, I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. If anybody who's, you know, dealt with the flash that's on the EyeSight camera knows, that thing is darn bright. Those LEDs are really bright, and you're going to be holding, you know, typically when you're doing a FaceTime thing, you're pretty close to that camera, so you'd like blind yourself. But actually, when I read more into this, you know, reading beyond the headline, because I saw the headlines first, and then, of course, as I was digging into the stories, what's actually going on is Apple's going to do something pretty clever in software where they actually illuminate the screen of the iPhone to give you a little bit more lighting, almost sort of like a soft, you know, LED kind of light. So to me, that's a lot more plausible than a true flash. And I don't know if that means it will actually flash, like when you go to snap the picture, it'll quickly sort of turn on the screen if it needs extra lighting, or if it's the kind of thing where you can have it on, say, if you're doing a video chat or something like that. I think for video, you'd want it on kind of permanently, and maybe you'll have the same kinds of controls as you do with the EyeSight camera. It's also expected that the new iPhones will have Force Touch built into the display. As a matter of fact, Mac Rumors noted, had a sort of leaked display component, and noted there was actually a new chip as part of that. And so some speculation is that may be a chip designed for the Force Touch technology. And I have a feeling Force Touch is going to be implemented a little bit differently in a larger screen device than it is, say, in the Apple Watch, or even in the trackpad in the new MacBooks. I think ideally you'd want it to be able to be sort of localized so that you can force touch in different areas of the screen and maybe have different things happen. But I don't know if that's actually how it will be implemented or if it's just sort of one extra level of gesture. It could be the latter, but I think the former would be a much better way to go. And I guess we'll find out when Apple actually demos it at the event. There's also a possibility of some new animated wallpapers, very much like some of the animated watch faces that you have on the Apple Watch. And we've seen some things in iOS 9 that looks like they're going to have like colored smoke and maybe koi fish swimming around that you could have on your screen. So nice little touch and enhancement. And if you've seen the animated wallpapers on the Apple Watch, you know these are very elegant. Apple did some really cool in-studio photography to get these shots, and I think they're going to just look really, you know, subtle, elegant, and beautiful. So I'm looking forward to seeing those. And I hope there's a bunch of different options that they have available. On the cellular side of things, we've talked a little bit about upgraded cellular chips from Qualcomm. You're going to be able to be capable of supporting faster LTE speeds up to 300 megabits per second, 50% faster than the current generation of iPhones. Of course, that's going to involve having to have carrier support. So who knows what your actual speed is going to be. It's going to come up down to which carrier you have and how quickly they upgrade their systems. It's also expected that Apple will have a new color option, a rose gold color, to actually match the rose gold Apple Watch. It's actually not going to be gold, so it's not going to come with that, you know, $10,000 Apple Watch price tag. But at least if you have one of those Apple Watches, you'll have a phone to potentially go along with it. And just if you like that color in general, it's a pretty popular color. And again, the gold colors are, I guess, very popular in China. At least that's what I've been told and I've read, and I've actually even heard from some of you who live in that region. So Apple may be stepping up to kind of help bolster sales in that region as well by adding the new color choice. Another thing that a lot of people have wondered about is, what is the storage capacity? Is this going to be finally the year that Apple dumps the 16 gigabyte model as the low-end model? Well, unfortunately, it's looking like Apple is sticking with the current storage lineup. So a 16 gigabyte option, then 64 gigabytes and 128 gigabytes. If you remember, Phil Schiller defended the 16 gigabyte size, saying that, you know, it's something that price conscious consumers really demand. And they sort of talk about iCloud services filling in the holes and reducing the need for more storage on the device. Now, I just wonder how that jibes with shooting 4K video and 12 megapixel, you know, photos. It just doesn't work out for, I think, a lot of people. And I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse on that 16 gigabyte size. I really wish Apple would bump up to the 32, but I've heard various reasons why Apple wants to stick with the 16 gigabyte model, including the fact that I guess 16 gigabyte chips are much more readily available and also much more affordable. So they can actually make a much healthier profit on that size of device. And then finally, as far as when we will actually be able to buy and pick up our iPhones, it's expected that Apple will announce them at the September 9th event with pre-sales going on September 11th, so the following Friday, and then shipments happening about a week later on the 18th, Friday the 18th, although some rumors have said the 16th, which would be a week from the announcement date, but typically Apple releases the new devices on a Friday. So I kind of threw that number out, and I'm going with it happening on the 18th. But as far as I know, that's about everything that we know about the next generation iPhones. Next up is iPads, and probably the biggest speculation around the event with regards to iPads is that Apple may announce the rumored iPad Pro. And yes, that is expected to be the name at this point. From everything I've been reading and hearing, Apple is going to go with the iPad Pro. This is the 12.9-inch version of the iPad, something I'm calling the Gigantipad, or the, I guess we could call it the Megapad as well. But this thing is going to be huge. It's supposedly targeted at pro consumers, artists, and I really think it's a device that's specifically targeted at the enterprise. Apple has announced some things recently with companies like IBM and Cisco, and we're going to talk about the Cisco thing here in a minute, and really trying to push into the enterprise. And I think this is a device that can, for a lot of office workers, potentially replace a laptop. And I think Apple is going for that market. So along with that means possible introduction of some accessories, including a Apple Force-enabled stylus for taking notes and things like that. And I'm not exactly sure how that Force Touch technology is going to be working in there. I think we talked last time that my speculation is Apple is going to use Force Touch as a more general term for pressure sensitivity and just anything where you're applying force to cause a different kind of gesture or reaction within their product. So more of a blanket generic term of that. And that would make sense in a stylus. But really in the stylus, I'm expecting it to be some sort of, you know, multi-level pressure sensitivity. Because when artists are using a stylus, they really want to go for the ability, you know, the harder you press, the thicker your line. You want more of that real world experience of actually using a pen or a brush or something like that. And, you know, Force Touch as it's implemented now is really just a couple levels deep. And I think on a stylus, it's going to be need to be a much deeper experience. The iPad Pro is also expected to be one of the first iPads to feature stereo speakers. So you're going to have speakers on both sides. And also on the accessory front, late breaking news was that the New York Times and 9to5 Mac think that Apple is actually working on a new keyboard accessory that could be announced alongside the iPad Pro. It's expected that it would be released sometime by the end of the year, so they might not have it right ready to go on sale along with the iPad Pro. But if you remember last month, there were some FCC filings that were uncovered about a new Apple Bluetooth keyboard that had backlit keys and a power button. So this would have supposedly, I think, rechargeable batteries built in. You'd kind of be able to dock it or plug it in and recharge it, take it on the go, and it would be really an accessory to go along with your iPad. I was in the Apple store recently, and actually Logitech has a fabric kind of keyboard, a really slim fabric keyboard that I think is great to go along with the iPad. It kind of feels like the same texture as Apple's smart covers. And this one looks like it's going to be more the Apple styling with the aluminum and the, I don't know if they'd go with white or black keys. I think maybe if they're going with the backlit, they'd go with the black keys. But we'll have to see. I think if Apple is going after this enterprise market, it absolutely makes sense for them to have a keyboard accessory. Because again, I think the target in enterprise is really replacing some of the laptops for people who are just doing office, you know, document work, surfing the internet, answering email, and those sorts of things. An iPad is a much more convenient form factor to carry around, especially if you've got a larger screen to work with. And with Apple's new split screen mode coming into iOS, you can do a little bit more multitasking on that sort of device. So I really think that's, you know, when we hear the announcement, Apple's going to be really focusing on those consumers. Now, Apple could call an audible. It's sort of like 50-50 on this, whether Apple will actually have it at the event. Some people are saying they might hold a separate event in October, and it's expected that the iPad Pro pre-orders will happen in October with shipments going on sometime in November. Now, for me personally, I think we are going to get the iPad Pro, and I think it's going to be the big announcement at the end of all of these sort of significant announcements. I mean, this is a really big deal. And we know that Apple has moved to a much larger venue, about double the size or double the capacity in terms of the audience. And so I think they're really going to want to have something to show off, unless they're using a big portion of that space as maybe a demo area. Some have speculated on that. But I think no. I think Apple's going for a huge splash with this event. And I think there's no way they're going to hold off from announcing the iPad Pro, especially if it's this close to being ready to go. And they need to give us some time to kind of think about these products and what we're going to buy. And if they have an event late in October, you know, and I know they've done this in the past, but I think they're just kind of missing an opportunity. They're missing a window. So I'm going to go, you know, plow forward and say, yeah, we're going to see the iPad Pro at this event. Apple's also expected to update the iPad Mini with an iPad Mini 4 version. It's going to be a nice little bump to the existing iPad Mini lineup, featuring a faster A8 processor, which would also mean that it would gain support for iOS 9 and split screen. I think the split screen is going to be a big deal and a big feature that Apple is going to focus on for the iPad lineup. And so bringing it to the Mini would kind of finish things up, because if you have it on the iPad Pro, we already have it on the iPad Air 3, and you know it's going to be iPad Airs moving forward. And then bringing it to the iPad Mini line just means it's supported across the board, and Apple is kind of finished up. Now, unfortunately, the iPad Air 3 is not expected to come out until sometime early next year. And I'm saying unfortunately really for myself, because I was really wanting to upgrade my iPad Air. I have an original iPad Air, and I skipped the iPad Air 2, and I've been waiting on the next generation, and it sounds like I'm going to be waiting a little while longer. I don't have much interest in the iPad Mini. I kind of gave up my iPad Mini because that size really wasn't enough of a difference from my iPhone. And I'm really, and I say this hesitantly, because when Apple shows off that new iPad Pro, I may be salivating. I don't know. I think it's too big a device for me, and I think I learned my lesson with the iPhone in going with the iPhone 6 Plus. I knew that was going to be too big a device for me, and it proved to be true. So, hey, I think I'm going to hold off, and I will wait for the next generation iPad Air, which just means Apple's not going to sell me an iPad, at least not this fall. But that rounds out the iPad lineup. And as I said earlier, I really think the Pro is all about the enterprise. And Apple and Cisco did announce a partnership this week. They are going to agree to make sure that iOS devices work more efficiently on Cisco-powered networks. And that even includes deeper integration with Cisco's voice and communication products that are used in enterprise. So things like video conference systems and things like that, tighter integration there. And as a matter of fact, Tim Cook even appeared on stage at Cisco's annual GSX Global Sales Experience sales conference right after the announcement to support the show support for the partnership. So I really think this is going to be a leg of their whole sort of marketing push on the iPad Pro, and I expect that to come out during the event. Next up, we have the Apple TV, and this is going to be a big boost for the Apple TV. You know, the Apple TV, it lost its hobby label a few years ago, and it has been kind of steadily growing in popularity, but it hasn't really been had its breakout moment. And I think this is where the Apple TV really gets its breakout moment. I mean, I guess you could argue early on, the first generation of the Apple TV made a pretty big splash, but I think this is going to be even bigger. Apple is really ramping up the specs. They're ramping up what the thing can do, and it's going to be a central part, I think, of a home hub strategy moving forward. And we're going to start to see Apple build into this version some of those bits and pieces. So on the hardware side, it's expected to get a little bit wider and a little bit thicker, which is interesting because we're used to Apple products getting slimmer. And earlier reports had said it was going to get slimmer, but the latest sort of rumors that we're hearing is that it's going to be a little bit bigger, probably, again, to accommodate more components, more things like more storage. It's going to be the first Apple TV to feature a dual-core A8 processor. And along with that, it will bring in new functionality like Siri voice control, which we've been hearing about. So Siri integrated. And that kind of plays along with the announcements that went out for the event that really had a Siri focus. And I think Siri will be another thing that's taking center stage across the board, but most specifically, I think, related to the Apple TV. It'll be interesting to see what kinds of new interactions Apple builds into that kind of product. I imagine the ability to ask about the weather, and there's going to be stuff related to searching for TV shows and content that you have on your Apple TV, or even up in iCloud or through Apple Music, or searching through your purchase content on iTunes. The remote, as we've been talking about, is expected to get upgraded a little bit, again, larger remote. Yay, finally. How many people are like me? Do you lose your Apple remote all the time because that thing is so darn tiny? I have to have like 20 of them in the house just so that I can always find one when I need to. No, I really don't have 20, but I lose them all the time. So anything that's going to make the Apple TV remote bigger is good in my mind. And really the reason it's supposedly being made bigger is that Apple is going to add an integrated touchpad into it. It's still expected to have a couple of buttons on there, although those are going to be updated a little bit as well. There's going to be a home button and a Siri button. Right now we have the menu button, which I guess is technically like a home button, and then you have the play pause button. But it's expected to have like a little microphone Siri button. So I would imagine that there's going to be a microphone integrated into the remote as well for doing Siri voice commands and dictation and those sorts of things. And we've also been hearing that the remote may have some possible motion control elements, so some gyroscopes in there so that it can actually detect motion and be used potentially as a gaming sensor or gaming device, I guess, because gaming is supposedly going to be a big element of the Apple TV as well. They're going to be getting universal search in Apple TV finally. So all of those content channels that Apple's been adding that you have to come out of and go back into. Quick little tip for you, if you don't know this already, I think we've mentioned it in the show in the past, but I use this all the time. If you're deep down in the Apple TV menus and you need to get back to the main menu, if you just press and hold the menu button for a couple seconds, rather than just tapping it to go back one level, press and hold it, it will go all the way back to the main home screen. It's a little trick for you there. But now you'll be able to actually search, and it will look for whatever you're looking for across all of the channels that you have set up on your Apple TV. And you're going to be able to do that, I think, with voice as well. So you'll just be able to say, hey, Siri, find me Star Wars. And it will bring back all the Star Wars TV shows and your Star Wars movies. And it won't matter where that content is. You'll be able to find all of it quickly and easily, something we've desperately needed for a long, long time, actually. And not many set-top boxes have that, so I think that is going to be a significant feature. Another thing Apple is supposedly doing is updating the user interface. That has gotten a little long in the tooth, right? It's not going to be really changed drastically. We're still going to have the little tiles and the channels and things like that, I believe. But you are going to get a slightly tweaked design that's going to have a little bit better navigation, make it easier to get back and forth, and also just be a little more streamlined for, you know, more modern televisions and things like that. It's going to kind of come into that design language that Apple's been building up, I think, across the product line. Another big part of Apple TV is going to be HomeKit integration. We're finally starting to get third-party HomeKit products hitting the market. It's taken a while, and I think Apple's really going to position the Apple TV as a secure hub for your connected devices. We've been hearing that HomeKit device data is going to actually be kept on the Apple TV and not in the cloud, and Apple will focus on that at this event, because to date, some of the other smart home products that are out on the market, security has not been that well thought out, and Apple has really put a focus on HomeKit of it being very secure. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why we supposedly have not seen a lot of third-party accessories is that Apple has been very strict about the security, even requiring new security hardware or chips to be built into HomeKit products to actually meet the specification. So I also expect that when we hear about Apple TV, since it does have the A8 chip, Apple's going to talk about the secure enclave and storing your device information actually in HomeKit, not sharing that stuff out and really maintaining and keeping your privacy. There has been some debate on whether or not the new Apple TV is going to support 4K video playback. And this is a tough one for me, because I think, as you know, as you heard earlier, I think Apple is going to add 4K video support to the iPhone. So if you can shoot 4K video, I would assume you're going to want to be able to play back 4K video, and you're going to want to do that on your Apple TV. So I think Apple is going to have 4K video support, but most of the rumors, most of the speculation is that not this time around, that Apple has deemed the technology is just too early stage, there's not enough 4K content out and available, and it's not something that they need to add. But certainly, I think with the chips and things that we're hearing about that are in there, it should be capable of supporting 4K. So I don't know why Apple wouldn't do that. It could be possible, I guess, that they don't announce it. It's in there kind of secretly, and we've seen Apple do this in the past, and people figure out that, you know, Apple can flip a switch at some point and support 4K video. But I think they're just going to support it, especially if they're going to support the ability to shoot it on the iPhone. So that's kind of it on the hardware side of things, but there's also a big software element to the Apple TV update. And most specifically, we're hearing that there's going to be a dedicated app store. So we're finally going to get apps. Apple is going to give them an SDK to developers so they can start developing apps for the Apple TV, third-party apps. I think it's going to, I still feel like it's going to be much more controlled. I don't think it's going to be a totally open environment, or at least apps that are going onto the Apple TV are going to be vetted even more strictly, I think, than the ones that we get on our iOS devices or on our Macs, because it really has to make sense for that kind of experience, the kind of input that you have with the remote, what's happening on the screen, I guess much in the same way as Apple Watch apps are going to be vetted, right? It only makes sense for certain kinds of experiences, and I don't think Apple's just going to let everything through. There is going to be a focus, I think, on casual games. I think that's going to be a big part of the App Store, and I fully expect Apple to show some gaming partners, bring them up on stage, and so show some really cool Apple TV games. And as a matter of fact, Apple just this week launched a new App Store Games Twitter account. So that's kind of a little hint that Apple is maybe moving a little bit more into the gaming space. And there's been a lot of people talking about, you know, well, is Apple TV going to be going after traditional gaming consoles like the PlayStation and the Xbox? I don't think those guys have anything to worry about from the Apple TV. I really think this is going to be more focused on the person who's more of a casual gamer, someone who typically probably wouldn't invest the kind of money that you would need to into a home gaming console system. You know, it's for those of us who like playing games on our iPhones and iPads and being able to take those experiences and expand them a little bit in the living room with the Apple TV. So I personally am very excited about the thought of a new Apple TV. As far as pricing and availability goes, we're hearing that it will be available in October, and pricing is being speculated at somewhere between $149 or $199, though most recent reports seem to be saying that Apple has settled on the $149 price point. Still a big jump up from where we are currently. The third generation Apple TV box sells for about $69 US. There could potentially be two price points depending on storage, and I guess we should talk a little bit about storage. I figured Apple would bump the storage up quite significantly, at least 32 gigabytes, maybe 64, but what we're hearing is that the Apple TV will have 8 or 16 gigabyte storage options, which seems like not enough storage to me, especially if you're bringing apps to the environment. I think the current Apple TV has 8 gigabytes built in just for doing its streaming thing. So unless they're adding an additional 8 gigs that's sort of separate from the built-in 8 gigs for the operating system and other things, I guess that could be a possibility. But for a total of 16, maybe that could work out. But, you know, once again, I think Apple is discounting the amount of stuff that people are going to want to store on their device. And especially if they're adding games, some of these games can be several gigabytes in size, say 3-4 gigabytes. Well, if you only have 16 gigs of storage, you can only put 4 major title games on your Apple TV gaming box. Again, it's casual games, I get that, but it just doesn't seem like enough storage to me. So I'm hoping we're going to hear more, but probably not. You're going to probably be looking at about 16 gigabytes of storage and a price point of $149 or $199. So also related to the Apple TV, we've been hearing about, you know, Apple working on this subscription TV service. Don't expect that to happen at this event. It's not very likely. Apple is still in negotiations with content providers, and a big sticking point seems to be the price point of the service. Apple supposedly wants a subscription TV service with content made available for about $40 a month, and that is not enough money to go around, I guess, according to the content providers. So that could mean the subscription TV service is being possibly delayed until sometime in 2016. And, you know, that's just tough stuff to do. It's very hard with all the different people that you have to negotiate with. So it doesn't surprise me that we're not going to get a TV service anytime soon. But Apple may be looking to make a end run around that, because Variety reported this week that Apple has been poking around Hollywood looking for actors and directors to possibly produce its own TV content a la Netflix and Hulu. They say that Apple actually made a bid to hire the hosts of the BBC series Top Gear, but lost that bid to Amazon. and also that Eddie Q had been talking to ESPN star Bill Simmons about doing an exclusive podcast for Apple before he was scooped up by HBO on a multi-year deal that's actually going to cover multiple platforms. So I guess they were only talking to him about doing podcasts, and he was looking for a little bit more, probably a little bit more money. I don't know. You know, I don't know how these things go down. But, you know, I think Apple is – that's great that they're going out to Hollywood. They're thinking about doing original content. I just feel like that's an area they shouldn't be getting into, at least not in that capacity. You know, not in the same capacity at Netflix and Amazon and Hulu are, because it's really not in Apple's wheelhouse. Sure, they could build out that system. And some might argue, well, they're doing Apple Music and they've got, you know, the Beats One channel. But really, that is not anything more than kind of curating content, which I think Apple is very good at. And I think they should sort of stick to that. So I've talked about this in the past. I still think a potential huge pool of great content creators and things that they could leverage could be found already on iTunes in the podcast section, both in the video and audio sections. Of course, I'm biased a little bit. I'll fully admit that. But doesn't it make sense that Apple could offer up a new platform for doing distribution and getting monetization for your shows? So they could build a subscription service out of hand-selected sort of content providers that already exist out there and shows that are popular, and help those shows grow, become bigger, maybe monetize them a little bit, just like they did with app developers in the App Store. They could set up some funding, some ways where somebody could pitch a show or an idea, bring it to Apple, and then, you know, maybe they provide a little seed money to get things going. But then after that, they build it either into a subscription service or just do, you know, the pay as you go. So you want this a season of the show, it's going to cost whatever the content producer wants to charge. And then Apple, you know, takes a cut for doing the selling and delivery components. And, you know, I think that could be a huge win for everybody. But, you know, what do you think about something like that? It seems to make sense. There's a lot of great content being produced out there. There's a lot of people that want to go independent and are just looking for a way to do distribution, a way to reach an audience and be able to sell their content to the audience. And I think Apple's proven this model of letting people produce content, be it iBooks or music or TV shows or movies, and them just taking the 30% cut really works. And I still have this huge fear of Apple going down what I call the 80s Sony path. You know, Sony was a huge consumer electronics company in the 80s, making some of the best and most popular products. And I think once they started diversifying, the products suffered a little bit. And I really like Apple as a consumer products company. We like to buy their stuff. It's not about, you know, necessarily the content. But maybe we're moving more in that direction. I don't know. I'm just kind of, you know, throwing ideas out here. What do you think? I mean, do you think it's good for Apple to get into this, you know, becoming a television or a movie studio? Or are they going to grow too big, too fast, get too fragmented, and then sort of lose sight of really what the company is? They've got other projects, you know, floating around there too, like the car project. It seems like, you know, it's hard to find really great engineers and keep them and stuff like that. And the more sort of pies you get your fingers into, it's just going to get a lot more messy. So I guess I'd really just like to see Apple stick to their core competency. And it's not to say that they can't grow, they can't move into those areas, but I just don't see the reason for it. I think they have other ways that they can solve this problem, this content problem, that they can very easily leverage and do it in a really massive and effective way that changes the industry. And Apple's really good at that. They're really good at changing up things. So don't follow along with what everyone else is doing. Yes, Netflix and these guys have been successful at producing shows, but for how long, and how long is that going to last? Why take that risk when you can leverage people who just want a way to distribute their stuff and they need a little help figuring out how to monetize that? So if Apple can provide that platform, I think it would be a huge win. But we still have some final products to talk about. So we hit all the big ones, I think. We've got the iPhone. You've got the new iPads, including the iPad Pro and the Apple TV. A little odds and ends. A few other things that we may hear about or may not hear about. The iPhone 6C 9 to 5 Mac is saying no on that, that Apple has been working on it, but it's simply just not ready to ship yet. They do claim that Apple plans to discontinue, though, the iPhone 5C. So this will be the event where that gets killed off. And the iPhone 5S will become the device that remains on sale for the with the on-contract price being dropped down to free. So that will be your new entry-level iPhone until the 6C can come out, I guess, sometime next year. And then I do think this is going to be very much focused on iPhones and Apple TV and iPad. It's not going to be a Mac event, but we have been hearing that there is a 21.5-inch 4K iMac in the works. The screen resolution is supposedly 4,096 pixels by 2,304 pixels. Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that Apple will update the iMacs with vastly improved LED technology. This displays will have better color saturation thanks to an LED phosphor material called KSF. I think we talked about that in a prior episode. He's also expecting that we'll see improved processors in the next update and does still believe that we will see new iMacs this quarter, but it's unclear at this point whether Apple will mention or announce them at this event. It could be something that just sort of silently happens in the background. Apple has done that. For my part, and I think I already went out on a limb on this when I did the Mac and Forth show, I do think Apple will do a quick, you know, sort of rundown of, you know, the State of the Union that they always do at the start of the show. And I think they'll talk about the OS business and OS X, and they'll talk a little bit about the Mac business. And they could potentially in that section, I think, announce an update to the iMac, announcing this 21.5-inch 4K iMac to go along with the 27-inch 5K. So I'm going to say I'm about 75% on that. I do think we'll get a little mention of a new iMac, but I think it's really going to be in passing. We'll get, you know, hey, here's this new one. It's got this display and here's the pricing and it's available, you know, on this date. And that'll be about the end of it. But that should round out this whole event. Is that enough for us? I am going to be a very busy man after this event, parsing through all that, getting you the information, trying to understand what all this stuff means and why we need it or don't need it and what's good and what's bad. And, you know, we'll be in that halo effect, that honeymoon effect right after the event, just blown away by all of this stuff. And hopefully I'm not hyping this up to you or myself too much and it doesn't all fall flat. Although there's always a little remorse too, right? You get this build up. The event happens. It either meets or doesn't meet or exceeds your expectations or falls short, whatever it is. And then we all take a collective sigh of relief afterwards to go, ah, that's over. All right. Now what's on to the next thing. But if you can't tell, I'm very excited about this event. I think it's going to be great. So I will be online. I will be tweeting. We'll try and set up the IRC chat room. If you've never participated in that, look on maccast.com to get information about that as the event's going on. We set up a little chat room where we can talk back and forth to each other and just give our first thoughts and impressions on all the announcements as they happen. It's a lot of fun if you've never done that before. And again, I'll have details up on maccast.com on event day. So just check there for that. But until the 9th, I guess, you know, that's all I've got for you for now. All right. Some of the latest numbers on Apple Watch sales were released this week by IDC. They think Apple has sold about 3.6 million Apple Watch units in the second quarter of 2015. If that is the number, Apple's estimated to have captured about 19.9% of the wearable market, which would put them just right behind Fitbit, who is estimated to have sold about 4.4 million units for the same period. So I think those are pretty good numbers for Apple Watch. Again, I think that's in line with what I was thinking by the end of the year. I think, well, Apple will have sold 5 to 6 million Apple Watches. I'm hedging my bets a little bit. I think earlier I really said 4 to 5 million. It's looking to be a little bit more than that if these numbers turn out to be true. And, I think that shows that the Apple Watch is actually selling pretty well. I think, you know, Apple has come out publicly and said that they have, you know, it's exceeded their expectations. And I think that probably is a true statement. And something that is helping Apple do that, I think, is Apple is moving the Apple Watch into retail stores outside of their own. So now that availability is sort of sorted out, we know that, you know, Best Buy and some of the other locations and partners that Apple has are going to be selling Apple Watches. And this week, Mac Rumors reported that the UK retailer Currys might be getting ready to sell the Apple Watch as well. And I think that just shows that there's a lot of interest outside of the sort of tech geek ecosphere for the Apple Watch. I'm starting to feel like the Apple Watch is even more popular among non-tech consumers than it is among tech consumers. And part of that might be the fact that it is an iPhone accessory, and just so many people have iPhones. And here's another bit of technology that I can pair with that, and it can do some other really cool things. And it's starting to get some buzz and hype. It's kind of been a slow build. You know, inside our little community, we were all excited about it right up front, and then maybe even a little disappointed when not all the features or all the things that we thought it could do proved to be true. Although day by day, I'm finding more and more use in my Apple Watch. And I think when Watch OS 2 comes out and we get native apps, I think, you know, the game is totally going to change, and I think it's only going to get bigger. So Apple is timing things right and getting into these retailers and pushing that out there. And there may be some new designs. You know, Apple is continuing to focus on the design of the Apple Watch. We're hearing a couple of rumors that at the event, one thing that might happen with Apple Watch is a couple of quick announcements related to new colors in terms of the metal finishes on the Apple Watch itself, and also some new sport band colors. The New York Times has a late-breaking report saying that Apple may have new metal finishes for the Apple Watch, including a less expensive gold version. So there's been these third-party companies that have been gold-plating Apple Watches for a few hundred bucks, and I think Apple's looking at that and seeing the popularity of that and thinking, hey, we should get in on that. Why don't we gold-plate some watches rather than, you know, building them out of solid gold, and maybe we can sell some $2,000-$3,000 Apple Watches here. And I think that's a good route to go, and it's sounding like that might happen. And then Mac Rumors says that Apple is also planning to bring out some new sport bands in different colors. There's only speculation as to what the colors might be. Most are thinking that we're going to see some deeper toned bands to go along with kind of the current neon colored ones. So think a darker blue and a darker green, maybe things that are a little more elegant, a little less sporty, but, you know, aren't falling in the price range cost of some of the higher end bands that Apple is selling. $50 price point for a nice floral elastomer, say navy blue band or a deep red, something like that. A nice forest green might be really nice, might have some appeal and could, again, broaden the number of people who are interested in Apple Watch, as well as just, you know, if you want to change up your design, you might want to have a couple different band styles sitting on your shelf, and this would be a great way to accomplish that as well. This next story is something that hit this week and hit big in terms of creating a little bit of panic in the Apple community. There was a story out there about 225,000 stolen Apple ID or Apple accounts. And many, many people forwarded me this story because the headline was completely shocking. And most places, you know, played it up as they normally do. And it was like, oh my God, you know, the app iTunes store has been hacked. What is going on here? You know, Apple has got a huge security problem. And it is awful, but not because the 225,000 Apple accounts were stolen. It's awful because of the link baiting BS that went on and with a lot of the media. Now, a lot of media did, you know, deep in their story, get to the real point of this, but they really buried the lead. And for something like this, you shouldn't be doing that because it caused all kind of panic. And again, I got a bunch of you, and rightfully so. When I saw this, I panicked a little bit too. Your heart leaps. You know, you sent me the story and said, hey, this is a serious thing. Well, yes, it's serious. You know, anytime iTunes accounts get stolen, it's a serious thing. But what you have to know is that, yes, a company called WeepTech found an iOS malware called KeyRaider that was actually out in the wild. And yes, the malware was used to steal 225,000 Apple iTunes accounts and passwords, but only from jailbroken devices. So this happened on jailbroken devices. And by the sheer fact of jailbreaking your device, it means that you've modified it. And by proxy, you've modified any of the security that it has built into it. And so all bets are off. Yes, guess what? Malware, if you have a jailbroken device, can get onto your iOS device. And this is how that got in there. So if you have a non-jailbroken iOS device, you really do not have to worry about this. You did not get your accounts stolen. iTunes was not hacked. This was not a whole backdoor thing on the entire server. A majority of the accounts that were stolen were actually stolen out of China. And as Jason Snell pointed out over at his Six Colors blog, you know, even, and again, this doesn't minimize the fact that these accounts were stolen, but even if 225,000 accounts were stolen actually from Apple, Apple has over a billion iTunes accounts. So that would be just 0.02% of the accounts. It would be a very minor impact. But even, you know, even there, not anything we have to worry about, because, again, if you're not jailbreaking, you aren't affected by this. And if you are jailbreaking, you probably already know the risk that you're taking. You know, I am not, this is not a rant, an anti-jailbreaking rant, but it just is one of these things that says if you're going to jailbreak your phone and then go out to these various sources and cross-load or cross-install applications, you know you're taking a risk. You've bypassed Apple security and something like this that could happen to you. But I wanted to point this story out because you may run across this headline, or maybe you saw it and maybe you were worried about it. And hopefully this helps waylay any fears that you might have. Ever since Apple hired Angela Arendts to come in and head up Apple Retail, we've kind of been hearing that Apple's been making plans to start to make over some of their retail stores. But we really haven't seen, we've seen some minor changes, some things happen. You know, most recently we saw that Apple took the iPods and moved them over into the accessories section on the store, and they got rid of the iPad display signs and have replaced that with some software. But in general, when you walk into an Apple retail store, it looks more or less the same way it has for the past, oh, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, something like that, depending upon what location. You know, there's some of those flagship stores in certain regions that have a different look. They're more built into the historical aesthetic of the place that the Apple store is in. But by and large, you walk into any mall in the U.S. or even across the world into an Apple store, and it looks pretty much the same. Well, now word is that Apple is working on moving its store in Memphis, Tennessee, and this could be the first Apple location to actually support a new look, a look that I guess is supposedly going to roll out to Apple retail stores globally. The leak came from some new designs that were submitted to the planning committee, the actually Germantown Design Review Commission, and they showed a design that has a 3-panel glass front and also, I guess, some glass panels in the ceiling to bring in a little bit more natural lighting. The 3 glass panels sound very similar to the current stores, but then also noted in the facade is the use of a matte granite material rather than the stainless steel panels that we see on the front of a lot of Apple retail stores currently. So it's looking like they're moving to more of a stone and glass look and material on the outside of the Apple stores. And then inside, there's mention of some new natural oak tables that I guess would have a slightly, you know, a darker tone than the current maple wood tables that they're using now. And so, you know, again, visual design changes, I think opening up much more light. I've been hearing part of the reason why they want larger glass panels on the front of the store is to kind of reduce that separation between sort of standing outside the store to looking in. But I think that's always an aesthetic that Apple has gone for from the very beginning. I think they're just figuring out how to make larger panels with maybe less seams, so that's a more seamless sort of experience. And also been hearing that the front displays are going to be changing up a little bit to bring in a little more natural materials and plants. And there's different speculation going back and forth. But the point is that eventually we should start to see this, starting with the store in Memphis, although there is no open date for the new Memphis store location. And again, this isn't a new store in Memphis, Tennessee. They're actually moving one of their existing stores. And when it opens up, it'll have this new look. And then the last thing that I have for you in the news for this week, Intel has finally announced the full lineup of their next generation processors, the Skylake lineup. This is using their 14 nanometer process, and it's looking like there's several chips now in the lineup that could fit nicely into new Apple notebook and desktop computers. As far as performance goes versus the current generation of chips that we have on our Macs, in general, it looks like we can expect about a 10% overall CPU performance improvement and about 30% improvement in graphics. They're also going to offer up better memory performance and energy performance, meaning about an additional hour of battery life compared to current generation Macs. The lineup is divided into a couple different series, and dependent upon which series you're in is going to determine where they might show up in future Macs. Now, all of this is just speculation, but it's looking like on the bottom end of the line, there's what Intel calls their Y-series processors, and they're being rebranded a little bit. These are dual-core processors. They're going to be called the M3, M5, and M7s. These are the ultra-low-power designs, so really designed for things like tablets or netbooks. Could be something that shows up in the very much slimmed-down next-generation MacBook. This processor ranges from about 900 megahertz to 1.2 gigahertz, so clock speeds right in line kind of with the current generation low-end processors from Intel. But again, you're going to get about a 10% performance improvements in CPU and about 30% performance in graphics, even staying at the same clock speed just because of the newer technology. On the middle tier, you've got new Core i3, i5, and i7 CPUs. These are part of the U series. They're going to have some options that will feature Intel HD 520 or Intel Iris 540 integrated graphics in the i5 and i7 designs. These processors will come in speeds ranging from about 1.8 gigahertz to 2.2 gigahertz. This would typically be the processor you'd probably find in a MacBook Air or a 13-inch MacBook Pro. So think that. And then the next level up in mobile processors is the Core i5 and i7H series designs. These range from about 2.3 gigahertz rather to about 2.9 gigahertz. This would be a typical processor you'd likely find in a 15-inch MacBook Pro. And then on the desktop side, they've got a couple of Core i5, i7 processors that clock from between 2.7 gigahertz to 3.4 gigahertz, again featuring Intel HD 530 graphics, and those could be great for some of the new iMac models, maybe even including the new 21.5-inch 4K iMac. Although, in looking at the timeline for these processors, Apple would have had to have pulled some strings if it does have a Skylake, so it may be older Broadwell technology, at least in the first generation of that model iMac, and then the Skylake version coming maybe later sometime next year. Because it's expected that these new processors are going to kind of trickle their way into Macs, and many of them really aren't going to be available until sometime in 2016. And one other thing to mention on the new Skylake lineup is that this is the first time Intel has announced a Xeon chip for mobile. So that could get real interesting if you have kind of Mac Pro level performance, but in a very high-end Apple notebook, and that could be something that could be very appealing to high-end photography, video professionals, 3D artists, and things like that. Could you imagine having full, you know, Mac Pro level performance in a Xeon chip inside a notebook? Those things will be screamers. Also probably come with a very hefty price tag. But exciting that we finally have a Skylake lineup, and we should, again, see these things start to make their way into Macs now through next year. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is MacPaw.com. They make a bunch of great applications, but I want to talk to you about Clean My Mac 3, because this is an absolute great utility for doing maintenance on your Mac. It's actually something I do use. And right now, MacPaw.com is offering MacCast listeners 30% off Clean My Mac 3. You just head to macpaw.com/maccast and you can get that discount. The pricing will come up. No coupon code or anything to enter. Just use that URL, macpaw.com/maccast. And it's a great time to pick it up because we've got El Capitan right around the corner. Capitan? I did it again. El Capitan right around the corner, and you can use Clean My Mac 3 to kind of get your Mac cleaned up and get ready for it. It's got a great user interface. It makes it really easy to get started and lets you have as much control when you're cleaning stuff up. So it can kind of go through, find things for you, let you know, hey, this is the stuff we found. You want me to clean this up for you? Or you can uncheck things, turn things on or off. And it really does make it, sort of cleaning up the junk from your old hard drive or from your hard drive in your system really easy. It can remove cache and log files. It can find your large and old files that you don't need anymore, help you move those off, get them archived. It can help you with uninstalling your old applications and making sure that all the stuff that gets hidden in the application support and cache folders, all that stuff gets cleared out so you don't have that hanging around and left behind. And then after that, it can actually monitor your Mac, and anytime you're deleting stuff or cleaning stuff up, it can remind you and say, hey, you want me to help you clean up the rest of these files that went along with this. It's a really handy tool to have in your Mac utility bag. And like I said, you can pick it up now, Clean My Mac 3 for 30% off by simply going to macpaw.com/maccast. And a big thank you to MacPaw for their support of the show. I received a lot of great feedback from you about my Genius Bar. I want to hesitate from calling it a rant. I think I maybe got a little ranty in there, but I was just trying to share my experience, frustration a little bit with making my Genius Bar appointment. And, you know, for sure, what I discovered was that if you need to make a Genius Bar appointment, use the App Store app on your iOS device if you want to get in there quickly. There's some tricks, and some of you, thank you, emailed me to show me a little bit quicker way in there. But a lot of them are very hidden. You know, I was looking for something. If I go to support.apple.com and I want to click a link and say make a Genius Bar appointment, you know, my frustration was I already know I want to make an appointment. Just take me right into the retail location and let me do that, which is what you can do if you use the App Store app. But, you know, they're trying to head some issues off at the pass and make sure that the people who show up at the Genius Bar really have a reason to be at the Genius Bar. So they walk you down this path of asking you some questions and trying to offer up, hey, here's some support articles we already have that might cover your issue. And I get it. I got it during that thing. But at the same time, sometimes, you know, you just want to do what you want to do. You want to get in and get out. And I was having a hard time making that happen. So I talked about that a little bit. And if you missed it, go back and listen to the last episode of the MacCast. But in my case, one of the reasons I was trying to get into the Apple Genius Bar was because I have an iPhone 6 Plus and it had, you know, it fell in the range of serial numbers that supposedly have this eyesight camera problem where, you know, you take pictures and eventually the eyesight stops doing its active image stabilization thing and actually starts kicking in when it doesn't need it, and then you end up with blurry photos. So I wanted to get my camera replaced. Even though I wasn't exhibiting the issue, I kind of had decided I just want to head it off at the pass. I'm ready to do it now. Apple will do it, and I wanted to get my thing in there and talk to them and see if they would replace the camera. And so I had a little bit of a hard time with that, with making the appointment, but Terry emailed me to say, you know, it ended up being pretty easy for him because he just contacted Apple Care support over the phone or through chat, and they identified his device as being in the range, and then they just simply offered to send him a replacement. So they actually sent a new phone out to him, and then he simply had to take his old phone, wipe it clean, you know, and then send it back to Apple in the box, and they paid for the shipping and sent the label, and he had a brand new iPhone. And that sounds to me like a much simpler process, Terry. So thank you for sharing that experience with us. And, you know, some of you, if you're thinking about doing this, maybe skip the Genius Bar altogether. Just go direct to Apple and see if they'll help you out on that side. And I also do hope that my rant didn't come off as sort of bashing the Genius Bar or Apple support, because I do want to say, and even once I got in for my appointment and stuff like that, I have always had a great experience at the Genius Bar. They did end up replacing my camera. The whole process took about an hour because the day I went in for my appointment, they sort of identified, yeah, we'll go ahead and we will replace your camera, but we're a little bit backed up now. Actually, they didn't have a technician at the store that day. A bunch of people had called in sick or something happened, and they weren't available to actually do the repair because they actually do the camera repair in store. So they said, you need to come back, and I would need another appointment for that. Of course, as you heard in that last episode, appointments were like a week and a half out. So what I decided to do was come back the next day because I was going to be in the area and just do a walk-in appointment. And this is another thing that I will tell you is Apple now has availability for walk-in appointments. You're kind of rolling the dice, so you don't really know. Depending upon how busy they are, how many people they have backed up in front of you, you may or may not be able to get in. It may be quick. It may be will take a long time. But they have this great process where you can check in, and they will tell you about how long they think your wait is going to be. And then they take your phone number, and you can leave the store. You can go out into the mall, shop around, do whatever you want. And then you'll get a text notification when they're about ready for you, saying, hey, we're almost ready for you. Come back to the store. And that's the second notification. So when you do this, the first notification you get is, yes, we've set you an appointment. And a lot of people get confused and come back into the store thinking, oh, they're ready for me. No, you have to wait for the second text. So when you get the second text, it'll say, okay, start to make your way back. And then you'll get a third text when they're just about ready for you. And that usually happens when you're back in the store. So I did that process and I waited about 20 minutes to be seen. And then it was about another 20 to 30 minutes for them to actually do the repair and for me to be able to get my iPhone back. And it went really, really great. So that was fine. Another issue that I had and another quick tip for you is that if you have more than one product or more than one issue with your device, you do need to make separate appointments. So a mistake that I made, and they were very kind about it to me. And again, this is the kind of experience I have with the Genius Bar. I had made one appointment thinking, for my wife's iPhone, and then I was just kind of piggybacking my iPhone on top of that. They said, technically, you're not supposed to do that. You kind of have to have separate appointments. But the girl was really nice, and she saw me anyway and took care of me. And that's generally the experience that I've had. But I can also say that I have confirmed from my sources at Apple that there is a lot of pressure being put on the Geniuses now to move customers more quickly through the Genius Bar and also to multitask, to even take on two or three customers at the same time. And I still do have concerns about what that does to the Geniuses just emotionally and, physically. I mean, it can be a bit overwhelming dealing with retail customers. You all know, we've seen it. If you've been into an Apple retail store, people get pretty irate when they hear they have to wait for an appointment or, that I can't help you with your issue right now or, those sorts of things. And to have to take on two or three customers at once or tell people they have to come back, those sorts of things. I've heard that they've been told they need to keep iOS appointments down to about 10 minutes and Mac appointments to like 15 minutes. I don't even know how that's physically possible. If you've ever gone in for one of these appointments, you can barely get anything out in about 10 minutes. And if you have a real technical problem, something the Genius needs to walk you through or help you with, it can easily take longer than 10 minutes. And they supposedly get evaluated for how quickly they have to process customers. And that just seems like the wrong metric to be looking at. I think really Apple should be looking at the quality of the service and, whether or not the customer's issue was able to be resolved and that the customer is satisfied. But sort of doing this, move cattle through the pen kind of thing as quickly as possible is just not really good for anyone. So I don't relish the Geniuses for sort of having to deal with this. And I have to say, like I said, the last time that I was in there, I didn't feel like I was being rushed. I did notice that my Genius was multitasking. He was taking on, I think, about three people. But, they do that because you might have someone that comes in and says, I need you to work on my iPhone. They say, have you done a backup? No, I haven't done a backup. So then they say, let's do a quick iCloud backup. So they can set up the person with an iCloud backup. And then as that's running, go help another customer. And so that was kind of the juggling that they did. Or if they're working with a Mac issue, maybe they're running an installer or they're running some sort of system check. And that's going to take a little while. So they did a great job of handling that. And they did a great job of being attentive and making sure that, when I was ready for them to come back, they were kind of there. So never at any time did I feel like I wasn't being serviced. But still, I kind of feel like they shouldn't even be pressured to sort of have to do that. Apple could hire some additional staff. They could have kind of other ways, I think, that they could deal with the crowds. And if they know that they have a lot of volume moving through there, they should be able to account for that and sort of understand that. And, you know, one source I talked to also told me that if the support is taking too long, longer than that 10 or 15 minute period, that they're supposed to tell customers that they need to make another appointment or come back. And I personally have never experienced that. So I'm kind of curious to get some other opinions on recent Genius Bar appointments. So if you've been into the Genius Bar recently, have you noticed or seen any of these changes, and have they affected your experience? Like I said, I've seen the changes, but I don't really think it hasn't affected my experiences. The Geniuses have always been really great. They've always spent the time to resolve my problems. I've never been told to go away and kind of come back. So I haven't had any of these negative experiences, but it's sounding like that's because of the great quality of the people at the Apple retail store and them really wanting to help their customers. Not that corporate isn't putting a lot of pressure on them to kind of do things differently. And some of the Geniuses are doing this at the detriment to sort of their advancement in the Genius Bar, it sounds like. It sounds like they can kind of get reprimanded or not sort of move up if they're not kind of meeting quotas and stuff like that. And this is just typical stuff that happens in retail. Anybody that's ever worked in retail, and I've worked in retail in you know, past lives, you all understand this is sort of how it works. And that's another thing about this is, you know, sometimes we think Apple is, you know, always better than the rest of the companies. We put that on Apple. But at the end of the day, they are running a retail store and they have to kind of go by retail rules and they need to get customers through and make sure customers are happy. It's just sometimes the way executives and management goes about this doesn't feel very right. And to me, in this case, it doesn't feel like they're handling this really in the right way. But again, this is all just my opinion and based on my experiences. So I'd love to get more thoughts and opinions from you. You can shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Let's talk a little bit about music. I like music. I think a lot of you like music as well. But, you know, music is this very personal thing. And I'm often reminded about that by you, because this week I got an email, and when I listen to music, I typically prefer to listen to my music collection on shuffle, but I do a shuffle by song thing, you know, where I just press play and then I shuffle my songs around. But Greg also likes to listen to music on shuffle, but in a little bit different way than I do, and he sent me this sort of comment and question about that.
Hi, Adam. This is Greg from St. Louis. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Anyway, I'm calling to talk to you today. I have a thank you, a call to arms, and just some musings. First, several weeks back, maybe even longer, you recommended the Monoprice Bluetooth headphones. I went ahead and bought a pair, and the kids were asking to borrow them so much, I actually bought each of them a pair, too. So we have three pairs of those. They're excellent. They're great. They work awesome. And I agree, at a fraction of a price, because I even got them on sale, so cheaper than when you said it on the past. So anybody who wants to take your recommendations on that, I would say, great. Take your recommendations on that and go for it. Secondly, those are Bluetooth headphones, and they connect to my iPhone. However, I don't like listening to music on my iPhone. I still prefer to listen to music on my iPod, and I don't have a Bluetooth iPod. I would go get the new Nano. However, the new Nano does not do what I want it to do. I still listen to music the old-fashioned way. I still buy CDs, I still rip them to my thing, and I listen to them album by album. And my favorite thing about my current iPod is I could just pick it up, I got it set to shuffle by album, and hit play. And then it plays how I want it to. However, the new Nano and the iPhone app and the iPod Touch app don't do that. There's no shuffle by album action. So, as you frequently do say, I go to the Apple website and I put in my request to add shuffle the album to these features. So I was hoping a call to arms that everybody would go, and maybe if we inundated them with that, to add the shuffle by album back into the iPod Nano and the iPod music apps, that would be great. That would just be awesome. And then thirdly, you know, I'm an iPad and an iPhone user. So my iPad's like an iPad 2, my iPhone's an iPhone 5, and I'm going to get new ones when they come out this fall. But I'm debating about size, and I know you got the iPhone 6 Plus, but I'm an artist, so I like to draw on my iPad, and I frequently think, boy, wouldn't it be great to have a larger surface, And then the iPad Pro is rumored to come out. And if it comes out, I'm kind of curious your thoughts. Like, if I upgrade to the iPad Pro, would it also be smart for me to go with the iPhone 6S Plus to kind of balance that out? Because there are things I do on my iPad that I never do on my iPhone, and there are things I do on my iPhone that I never do on my iPad. I mean, the games I play on my iPad, I don't play on my iPhone, and vice versa. But I wonder if I go up to that size, if my habits would change in that manner. Anyway, I was just curious your thoughts. Thank you for an awesome podcast, and keep it up.
Hey, I will. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate your comments and your question. Actually, I want to, I guess I'll just address each one in order, starting with the headphones. Yeah, I love those Monoprice headphones. I still do. They're still great. The battery life on them is absolutely amazing. They are about US $49, right around 50 bucks when they're not on sale. I've seen them go on sale as low as about $28 over at monoprice.com. And I think they're simply just called the Bluetooth USB on-ear headphones with microphone or something like that. They don't have any kind of fancy name. It's this long descriptive name. So if you're looking for them on monoprice.com, that's what you're looking for. And yeah, I can't recommend them enough. I think they're absolutely great for the price. So I concur with that. And thanks for backing me up on that one, Greg. And when I first, now talking about the Shuffle by Album thing, when I first heard your question, I misunderstood what you were asking, because I thought, well, you know, I have the music app, and I'm pretty sure you can go in the music app and you can select an album, and then when you select on the album, you can shuffle it. So you go into the music app, you tap on My Music, and then you, in the drop down, you have to pull down so that you're viewing by album, and then once you have all your albums listed, if you simply tap on the album, right at the top, there's a shuffle button. I thought, well, what are you talking about? There's a shuffle right there. And so you know this. I emailed you back, and then you responded and said, no, Adam, maybe it wasn't clear, but what I'm talking about is this feature that I didn't know about. You pointed out this great feature in your follow-up email that I didn't even know existed. And it's that you can or could go in and shuffle by album, meaning that you hit play on your entire music library, it will randomly select an album, play that entire album, and then go on to another randomly selected album. And it still works on iTunes. So if you're like me and were unaware of this feature, what it is on the Mac, you go into iTunes and you go under the control menu, and then you scroll down to the shuffle section, and in there you can turn on and off shuffle, you can shuffle by songs, but you can also shuffle by album. And I think there's also a shuffle by grouping. So if you change it to shuffle by album and then go back to your entire music library and don't select anything, just press play on the entire music library, it will do exactly what I just described. Grab an album, play it all the way through, grab another album, play it, you know, playing it all the way through, and so on and so on. Really cool feature. You're right, Greg. And it's a bummer that that doesn't exist in the music app anymore. So if anybody else really likes that feature, I would take up Greg's call to arms and go to apple.com/feedback and click on music or iTunes and give them that feedback. Say you'd really like to have that feature back. And Greg, for you, what I did was I tried to go out and see, well, is there some other option, some other way to work, do this, or is there some sort of workaround? I know you had done some looking yourself and hadn't found anything, but one promising thing that I found was there were a couple of apps in the App Store that claimed to kind of bring back this Shuffle by Album feature. And one that looked really promising to me was an application called Tap Tunes. And I sent you the link to it. I'll put a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com, although it may not end up working for you, because I went and tested it. And well, one of the reasons I picked this one is in looking at all of the ones on the App Store, this one seemed to have the nicest UI, and it was a very album-focused UI. So if you're very into albums, it kind of gives you this grid of album covers, and they have different layouts you can do. There's kind of a almost like a cover flow style view that's a little more vertical that you can do, or you can just get an album grid. And there's even an in-app purchase for a different kind of style for viewing your albums. But the idea is you view your album, you tap on it, and then you can play an entire album. But there's also a setting, if you go into the settings, to turn on Shuffle by Album. And when you do that, there's a little plus symbol down in the lower left-hand corner of the app. You tap on that, and there is a Shuffle by Album thing. And you can do that by all your music, or you could look for albums by a particular artist and only do shuffle by those albums. And it looked great, but when I tested it, it didn't work for me. I couldn't get it working. So I left some feedback for the developer, and he got back to me and said he tested it on his device, although he was running iOS 9, and it looks like Apple may have taken out the Shuffle by Album API completely. So the API that he's using to enable that feature may or may not be working. So I'm still doing some back and forth with him at this point, but that might not work for you. And I found another application called Smart Shuffle, and I tried that one, and that one wasn't working for me either. So I'm guessing that Apple did something at the core level to make Shuffle by Album really not possible. So it really may be we need to go to Apple and ask them to put that feature back in. And so, unfortunately, unless somebody else in our community actually knows of a way to do this on iOS devices or iPods, other than, you know, using an older iPod, please let us know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and we can follow up on another show. Or if you know a third-party app that is still working in iOS 8.4.1, is that the current version that we're at, then let us know about that as well. But, you know, Greg, that's sort of where I'm at with the Shuffle by Album stuff. And then on your last comment about larger devices, you know, I think this is really a personal choice, and it's going to come down to your usage. For you being an artist, I think the iPad Pro is going to be perfectly targeted at you. So if you're in the market for a new iPad and you're interested in a larger screen device, then by all means. The thing is that will that then mean that iPad sort of loses the iPad utility for you? And you know, that's only a call that you're going to be able to make. And then the second, I guess, part of that question is, can a larger screen iPhone kind of fill that gap and fill in that space between iPhone usage and smaller iPad usage? And for me, you know, I guess I can only speak from my personal experience. For me, that didn't really work for me. I will say that generally my iPhone habits did not change when I got a larger screen iPhone. So that my iPhone 6 Plus did not become sort of the one device that could replace my iPad experiences and my iPhone experiences and sort of combine them into one. And it's probably the one big reason that I'm actually going to downsize, because I didn't get enough benefits out of the larger iPhone to outweigh the disadvantage of not being able to easily carry it in my pocket and things like that. I'm still carrying two devices. I still take my iPad with me, my iPad Air, which is then, you know, the larger 9.7-inch size. And to me, that's the perfect size for me. I actually have no interest in the Gigantipad because I think it's way too big. I think it's going to be the same experience on the iPad that I had with the iPhone for me. But will it work for you? I don't know. You know, similar in the story, it's one of the reasons I gave up my iPad mini, because the iPad mini just wasn't large enough and it wasn't a different enough experience from my iPhone experience to kind of be those separate devices. And I like having the separate devices. There's certain people that are trying to kind of get all in one. And so a large screen iPhone could maybe replace an iPad, and that's one less device in your life. But I like having different devices for different purposes. The thing about what your question has is, I think for you, it sounds to me like, you know, moving to a larger screen iPhone, it's still an iPhone experience. So I don't think that's going to change the kinds of interactions that you have on your iPhone. The question will be, are you comfortable with having a device that is that large that you sort of have to carry around? But I think it's still going to be a phone experience. And then if you go to the larger iPad, the question will be, is that going to be able to fulfill the sort of use cases that your current iPad does? And I think it probably can, but again, it might end up being too large of a device. So I think you're going to have to think about the device size more than sort of what you're using it for. I think the iPad is still going to be used for iPad things. I think the iPhones, regardless of size, are still going to be used for iPhone things. The question is going to be, how comfortable are you with the larger surface? And I think for drawing and doing the kinds of things that you do with the iPad, I think it makes sense. You know, I like to draw on my iPad occasionally, but it's not my primary use. If your primary use is drawing, I think having that larger screen is going to be a really, really nice feature. But ultimately, you're going to have to make the call for yourself. So I don't think I gave you the answer, but hopefully I gave you some things to think about. And thanks for sending in your comment. When Apple updated the latest version of the photo application on iOS, a big part of that is this new iCloud photo library and the ability to put your entire photo library up into the iCloud storage system. And we've talked about this on the show. If you've been listening, you know that I've chosen to take advantage of that, and I'm actually really enjoying the service. And I'm putting all my photos up there. And then on my iOS devices, I have them set up so that I'm using the optimized storage option so that it's not eating up all the space on my iOS devices. But I also have larger iOS devices. I have an iPad that's a 64 gigabyte and I have an iPhone that's a 128 gigabyte. So very rarely am I low on storage. But Andy emailed me this week, and he is using iCloud Photo Library, but he's still having problems with storage, even when using the optimized storage on this device option. And Andy, I wanted to address your question because I am, I think, in the same boat as you are. I'm still completely confused on exactly what the optimized storage on this device option does and how it works, because in Andy's case, he has an iCloud Photo Library that he told me is about 200 gigabytes. And even after enabling iCloud Photo Library with the optimized iPhone storage option, it's still filling up his device to the point where he's getting low disk space errors and can't put more stuff on his device, can't really work with his device. And that could be, I imagine, Andy, is really annoying. And constantly having to manage that storage is something that you want to move away from. And so the question was, you know, how do you stop this from happening? And I did some back and forth emailing with Andy. Andy told me he has about 1.5 gigabytes of free space on his device typically. And so, Andy, the only place I knew to begin was to kind of look at my library, compare it to yours, and see how much storage photos were using up, you know, with the optimized storage on this device option on my iOS devices. So I looked at my what's in my iCloud Photo Library, and I have about half the amount of photos that you have. I have about 94 gigabytes of photos in my iCloud Photo Library. And when I went to look at my devices and see how much storage that was eating up, on my smaller device, on the 64 gigabyte iPad, it was using up about 2.5 gigabytes of storage. On my iPhone, my photo storage was around 10, but that's probably a lot of that is actually the photos that are sitting in my camera roll, not what's in my iCloud Photo Library. So my guess is that just the thumbnails in the larger, or the rather smaller optimized versions of the photos in your library are what are eating up all of your space. With a photo library that large, a 200 gigabyte iCloud Photo Library, even when things are optimized, it's my understanding what Apple stores on your device is a smaller sized version, an optimized version of all of your photos along with all of the thumbnails, so that when you bring up your photo library, you can browse through it and you can actually look at your photos. But then when you go in to look at a larger version, it's then when it'll sort of pull down a larger copy. And even there, I think it's pulling down a slightly optimized version, because what you can do is you can do edits and things on your iOS device on the smaller optimized version. And then what it'll do is it'll sync those changes up into iCloud and then back over to your Mac and things like that in the higher res version. So the higher res version is actually stored up into iCloud, you know, the full resolution version. And they can just apply those edits and changes and stuff like that, even though what you're seeing on your iOS device is more of an iOS device optimized image. But I think even those optimized images are going to eat up a significant amount of storage space if you have a large iCloud Photo Library. So that's my guess as to what is going on, and that 1.5 gigabytes for the size of your photo library just frankly might not be enough available storage. I could be wrong, but I did some searching around and I couldn't find any specific information to say, you know, this is how it works and this is how much storage, even in optimized mode, each kind of photo uses up. I'd love to know that information. So if somebody's done some research on this or has run across an article, please let me know about it. But, you know, this is another reason, getting to back to what I was talking about earlier about Apple keeping around the 16 gigabyte iPhone with a camera sensor that's going to let you take 12 megapixel pictures. This is going to be the problem. You know, the cloud storage that Phil Schiller talked about is sort of offsetting this issue really isn't going to offset it for everyone. And as we get larger movies and things on our devices, 16 is just, I think Apple is doing a disservice to its customers in selling them a device and sort of selling them on this idea that they can use cloud storage and it's going to be enough storage for them. Everybody I know who recently has gotten a 16 gigabyte device, be it an iPad or an iPhone, has had at some point some buyer's remorse when they realize they're constantly having to manage storage on their device. So I think it's just a really bad idea. But kind of getting back to Andy, something that might be able to help you is, you know, think about the size of your photo library. And this is something I personally have been thinking about with my own photo library since enabling iCloud Photo Library. And maybe that's part of Apple's plan, too, is to get us thinking about our photo storage. And do we really need to have this many photos in our photo library? Digital clutter has become so easy in our lives, right? Because it's like you run out of storage, you just get more storage. And I think this trend to, you know, smaller hard drives, more, you know, smaller built-in flash storage that you can't sort of swap out or make bigger might actually be a good thing, because it might start to get us to stop being digital pack rats and to simply just carrying around all of our data with us all of the time and just adding more and more to it and never cleaning anything off, never doing any housekeeping. So one way you could work around this, I think that would be most effective, is to maybe go through your photo library. And I just did a quick assessment on my own photo library, and this is what I came up with. I have about 16,000 photos in my photo library, and my guess in going through it is about 1/10 of those images are really the ones that are any good or the ones that I really truly care about. The rest of those, I probably could throw off into, you know, the digital version of a shoebox. I probably could make a backup of my entire library, archive off all of the photos that I really kind of want to keep, but I don't care about, that I don't need to see on a daily basis, and then remove those from my main photo library. You know, make a backup photo library and just have that be the thing, and then just go through my main photo library and delete off everything that I really don't care about. All those blurry pictures, all the screenshots that I captured, all those stupid things that I posted up to Twitter. I don't need those in my photo library, but they're all there because it's so easy. Because, hey, I got tons of storage. I just keep adding to it and bigger and bigger. I mean, my wife's photo library, I want to say, is around 100,000 photos. I think she's about, you know, five times as large as mine. And it's getting really cumbersome. And it puts a burden on her system. It slows the photo application down. It's gotten better with photos. But, you know, iPhoto used to be a dog when you would open it up on her library. And that's, you know, just us being kind of lazy about it, I think. And not to say that offensively, you know, I don't say that lightly. I think, you know, we're all pressed for time, but maybe just a little sort of photo editing. And this is something professionals do all the time, right? They shoot rolls and rolls of photos, and they do photo editing, and they kind of only keep their best shots. And maybe we need to start to do a little bit more of that. And there's applications and things like that out there that can help us do that as well. So I would say try that. If you really don't want to have to buy a larger storage device, maybe just archive your photos and get your iPhoto library, the thing that you sync up into the iCloud photo library, down to a little bit more manageable size. And that might be a way to go. So I hope that helps you out. If anybody has some other tips and tricks or things or has insight into how this all works, be sure to let me know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. A little more housekeeping stuff to talk about. You know, we've got a new OS around the corner. OS 10, 10.11 El Capitan is upon us. We should probably be getting it sometime in October. And Sean emailed me to talk about an older iMac that he had, a 2010 model, that he said, you know, physically it's working fine. You know, everything's working. It's running great. But it is beginning to show signs of its age. And he wanted to know, you know, what can I do to kind of eke a couple more years out of this Mac, this iMac? And, you know, my recommendation to you, Sean, would be the typical stuff that we talk about in terms of hardware upgrades, and that would be, you know, upgrading to an SSD, and internal would be great, but I know, you know, some of us don't want to crack open the iMac, especially that model, because you got to kind of go in through the front glass with some suction cups. It's a little bit tricky to do, but either an internal or an external SSD, you know, hooked up on the USB, I think that model had USB 3, a USB 3 external SSD, and moving your boot operating system onto that could do some things to significantly speed up your performance, or do an internal one. And then if you haven't done it already, upgrading the RAM between those two things, you could gain some pretty good performance and probably eke another couple years of really good usage out of that iMac. So those would be the things I would look into. But then another thing, just on the software side, is, again, do some housekeeping, do some backup and erasing and reinstalling of apps in the operating system and that. And with a new OS around the corner, that becomes, I think, really a good time to actually do something like this, to do a clean install of your operating system, to look through your Mac, make an assessment. Do I need all these files that are on my hard drive? Can I archive some of this stuff off and clean it off a little bit? Can I get rid of, you know, a bunch of applications that I really don't use anymore that I've just built up over the years? Because a lot of us, right, you get the new operating system and you just upgrade and you keep upgrading. And sooner or later, you find out you're 5 years down the road and you've never done a clean install of your operating system. And every app that you've ever tried or installed, even if you haven't used it in 4 years, is still sitting on your hard drive. And all those things can kind of build up to this electronic clutter and just slow things down. So I would do a little assessment and cleaning of things up. And then maybe when LCAP comes out, maybe you want to do a clean install of your operating system and your applications to even further clean things off. So if you're interested in doing that, the best way to do it, the way I recommend doing it, is first make sure that you have full backups of your system and you have at least two full backups. I personally have three. I have two local and one in the cloud. And take some time to confirm that those backups work and that you can restore from them and you can get data back off of them. Because sometimes we've just let those things run for years and there may be a problem with the hard drive or something like that. And you don't want to discover after the fact, after you've erased your hard drive and all your data, that you can't restore from your backup. So do some spot checking. See if you can go in to, you know, Time Machine and recover a couple files that maybe you deleted recently. Just verify everything's working. Maybe even run Disk Utility on the drive if it's an external drive that backup's on, to just make sure that it's working. But make sure you have all your backups, and then, you know, run the El Capitan installer. And then the first thing that you want to do is go into the Disk Utility application rather than just do an over-the-top install and erase the drive and then clean install the operating system. And then after the install happens, go through. You can use the Migration Assistant to restore your user accounts and your data from your backups, but uncheck the option to bring back your applications. Don't have it, you know, bring back your applications. And I probably should have mentioned earlier in your prep, you know, for apps, make sure that you have any product keys or registration information handy so that after you install the operating system and after you've checked and run any app updates or OS updates through the App Store, that you can reinstall just the applications that you really need from scratch. So another thing I like to do as part of the initial assessment is go through my applications folder and look at all the applications, go, okay, which ones of these am I really using? And then I'll write them on a list. And I've found many times when I go through this process, about a third of the applications stay and about two-thirds of them never get reinstalled back on the system. And that's great because that means, you know, those application support folders and all those things are actually cleaned out of all of that clutter and that garbage. And you'll end up with more disk space. Things will just run better. And it's a really great way to go. And after you've done all that, don't forget to re-enable your backups on your new cleaned out system. I do like to keep around my old backups for a couple weeks just in case I missed transferring something over. So I typically will buy a couple of extra hard drives right before a new operating system comes out, just to have them handy so that I can do, you know, new backups on the new drives and kind of keep the old backups around. And then once I've verified everything is up and running and I don't need those old backups anymore, I just repurpose those old drives into some other use. You know, hard drives are relatively inexpensive these days. You can get, you know, multi-terabyte drives for around $100. And I just feel it's a pretty good investment, especially now that we don't have to buy our operating system anymore. So you're saving money there. Take some of that savings and buy some extra backup drives. And it's good to just replace any old backup drives that you might have anyway. And again, this is another good time to do it as we have a new operating system coming out. So first recommendation would be maybe look into upgrading some of your hardware. Second recommendation would be maybe do a clean install of OS X when OS X El Capitan comes out, if you're planning on running that. Or you could just re-clean install Mavericks if that's the operating system you want to stick with. And then the third thing I would say is if you don't want to do a full clean install of your operating system, then just a good general house cleaning on your Mac. Again, going through folders, looking at your documents folder, backing up stuff, getting off old files that you really don't access or get to anymore, you know, going through doing repair permissions, cleaning out your file and system caches using a tool like Cocktail or Onyx, use a tool like Daisy Disk or Clean My Mac, which I mentioned earlier, you can get 30% off of. Another quick sponsor plug. They are a sponsor, but it is a really great application for kind of managing and doing this sort of thing, right? They have a tool in there that'll go through and find all of your large files. They have a tool in there that will go through your photo library and clear out a bunch of caches, or your music library and clear out a bunch of stuff, your old mobile backups that you don't need anymore. It can identify these files, sort of show them to you and say, hey, do you really need these around, or do you want me to go ahead and clean these out? And it works really great. So look for those old outdated files, old app remnants. Another big culprit on hard drives is, email attachments. If every time you open up an email attachment inside the Mail app in OS X, it saves a copy into your library mail folder in the mail attachments. So you can go through there and kind of clean that stuff out. So just do a little cleanup, do repair permissions on your drive, check your drive, and then you'll be, nice and healthy and ready when you do the LCAP upgrade. And maybe you can just do an over-the-top upgrade and save yourself a bit of time. So those are all general things that I would say you could do to kind of eke a little more life out of your 2010 iMac. And even if you don't have an old iMac, sometimes it's good to do a little bit of this house cleaning as well. So consider that. I know I'm considering it with my 2011 MacBook Pro. I'm long overdue for doing a clean install, and I think I'm going to use this next OS upgrade as my excuse to finally do it again. All right, so I hope that helps you out. And again, thanks for your email. All right, our thing of the moment for this week. This one actually is something I don't own yet, but I want it. I want this thing so badly. You may have seen this. It's actually Force Friday week. Star Wars is doing a big push promotion for the new Star Wars The Force Awakens movie. And a character in that movie that you may have seen, and he's actually in the trailer, so if you've seen the trailer, is the new droid robot, BB-8, the sort of round version of R2-D2, orange round guy with a little floating head on the top of the spinning ball. And the folks over at Orbotics, the makers of Sphero, actually were tapped to build that unit for the movie, or at least consulted. I don't know the full level of their involvement, but they were involved in some capacity. And they have made a toy version of BB-8. So the BB-8 by Sphero. If you go to Sphero.com, Sphero.com/Star Wars, there's a video. You can check this thing out. And it went on sale today. As I started to record this podcast, I checked. It's already back ordered by 2 weeks. So if you want to get your hands on one, you probably want to order it sooner than later, because I think this is going to be a hot holiday item. Although I think they did also announce on their Twitter that it was going to be available in Apple retail stores. So you may be able to check your local Apple retail store and see if they've got one. They're not cheap for a toy. It's $150 US, $149.99. But when you see the video and you see this thing, you're going to go, I don't care what it costs. I've got to have one of these things. If you're a Star Wars fan at all, it's just the head attaches with a couple little magnets, and it has this amazing personality. When you first turn it on, the head kind of tilts around and it makes little whirly beepy noises. They actually took the time to kind of put two magnets in the head so they actually can control how it moves back and forth, and it really has this kind of personality, makes all the sounds from the movie. And then it comes with an app that you put on your iPhone or your iPad, your Android device, that you can use to control BB-8. And he also has some autonomous features that you can work with as well. There's voice commands. He can supposedly learn about his environment, so you can put him down and he can kind of learn where obstacles in a room are. He can even show you the pattern that he has moved around the room in the app, and you can put him into a little patrol mode where he'll go around on the floor and kind of patrol and make his little beepy noises. Or you can, control him with your iPad. There's a Star Wars theme induction charging base, so you put him on the little charger, and he even does a cute little head tilt and stuff like that when he's charging up. It's just really, really neat. And I'm hoping to get my hands on one to do a review. I've reached out to Sphero, and hopefully we'll get one, and I can do a formal review for you on a future episode of the MacCast. But for right now, go check this thing out. I'll have links to it in the show notes at maccast.com. The BB-8 Robot by Sphero, the thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I will be back with you hopefully Wednesday or Thursday right after Apple's event. If you want to catch me live, I'm going to be super busy on Apple event day, which is why I may or may not be able to get a podcast out right on Wednesday the 9th. Right after the event, I mean literally right after the event, I've been invited to be on Mac Break Weekly on Twit with Leo Laporte, so you can catch me there. There'll be a live stream of that. Follow me on Twitter during the day, and I'll be tweeting all this stuff out so you'll know when and where the links are for when that stuff is happening. And then I will be quickly ducking out of Mac Break Weekly because I've also been invited to be on the Daily Tech News Show with Tom Merritt and actually Scott Johnson from, you know, Nerdtacular and Frog Pants Studios and all the great podcasts over there. And I'm super, super excited about being on with those guys because, you know, Scott's a big Mac fan, Tom as well, and it's just going to be fun to talk to them about all that stuff. And that will be, I think they broadcast that live as well. And if you can't catch either of those shows live, of course, you can just subscribe to their podcasts and the podcast feeds on iTunes and catch me there. And yes, there will be MacCast coverage. Again, don't forget about the IRC live during the event. Check MacCast.com for the links to that. It's actually, I can give you that. It's going to be MacCast.com/chat. If you go to MacCast.com/chat, you'll find the information on the IRC and how to access that. And there's even a web interface if you want to do that. Although I think it's still Flash based, unfortunately. So you probably will have to fire up Chrome if you want to get in there if you don't normally run Flash on your system. But it's going to be a great day. Super excited about it. And I hope to see you there. And if not, we'll talk after the event about all the great stuff that Apple has announced. And that's going to do it for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. MacPaw.com. You can get 30% off and clean up your Mac with Clean My Mac 3. Just head over to MacPaw.com/MacCast to take advantage of that offer. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander Touch. And be sure to check out PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their software by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Remember, you got the new iPhone coming, so get some cash for your old iPhone to help pay for that. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And TunnelBear. TunnelBear is really simple VPN to allow you to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today for free. Just head to tunnelbear.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the show, you can send your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Or if you prefer voice, you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows and you use the social medias, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community, and you can find that at google.com/plus, and that's the plus symbol, google.com/plusMacCast. Hope to see you online between shows, but that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.